case, and now going to spend some time on impairment. Dana, are you going to continue the discussion up?
Yes. Do I need to? Oh, this is on. Okay. So in the last ASF meeting, we presented the preliminary feedback we got on our exposure draft. And generally, that feedback that we presented to us is consistent with the final feedback we got. The feedback that we got showed that we have a lot of agreement with and support for the proposals, but despite the overall agreement, additional work is needed, for example, to ensure that the model captures all the items that suffer significant deterioration in credit quality, the definition of default, the stage one measurement, and some general clarifications on the operation of the model. So the ISB started to redeliberate specific topics on our proposals in September. These are the papers that you should have received, so paper 5A, 5C, 5D, and 5E of the September board meeting. The approach of the board is that we and the FASB each redeliberate potential changes and clarifications to our own model under the presumption that we each proceed to finalize our own model. However, the topics are redeliberate at joint meetings so that we can each participate in each other's discussions. And then any formal decisions about the possibility for convergence will then be made after considering the amendments the ISB makes to our own proposals and the changes that the FASB makes to their proposals. So with this, I guess I kick off for today. Today we will give you an overview of the decisions taken by the ISB in September and the topics that still to come. And then we will open for any comments or observations that you have on the model, and in particularly, obviously, the September topics. So if I first go to paper 5A, paper 5A, the topic is the responsiveness of the general model. And the objective of the impairment model, obviously, is that lifetime expected credit losses are recognized on all financial instruments that have significantly increased in credit risk since initial recognition. So this should take into account the best available information, including forward-looking information that affects credit risks. So I think we also already touched a little bit on this in the previous meeting where we presented the feedback, and it also was raised by some of you that participants in the area of retail products don't have updated information at an individual exposure level before loans become delinquent or before other borrower-specific factors occur, such, for example, restructuring. And so the responses that we got was also that some respondents were concerned that in practice people will resort to using just the 30 days past due rebuttable presumption as the primary indicator for recognizing lifetime expected losses, even if more forward-looking information is available. So I think that was one point that was also raised last meeting. And our fieldwork as well as the responses also showed that. So paper 5A considers how to ensure that the impairment model captures significant increase in credit risk on a timely basis, even if it's not identified on an individual exposure level yet. So situations such as when portfolio expectations materialize as initially expected, or situations where there are changes in factors that affect credit risks. So for example, if there's a change in unemployment factors. From a staff perspective, we thought at a minimum that the board needed to emphasize that the objective of the impairment model is to recognize lifetime expected losses on all financial instruments for which there has been significant increase in credit risk. We also thought that we need to emphasize that forward-looking information that is available with undue cost or effort must be considered. So an entity cannot only rely on delinquency information to assess significant increase in credit risk, and that the assessment of significant increase in credit risk don't need to be identifiable on an individual exposure level. So the paper discusses alternatives and approaches or ways or how entities could think about capturing significant increase in credit risk on a timelier basis. And in paragraph 8, we provided the board with three alternatives. The first alternative was to just clarify the proposals on significant increase in credit risk, as I just presented, so just the three points that I raised, or to clarify the proposals and prescribe specific methods how to address significant increase in credit risk on a timely basis on a portfolio level. Or the third alternative was to clarify the proposals and provide examples to reflect the intention of the proposal of the proposals. And the board tentatively decided on alternative C, so the last alternative, to clarify the proposals and to provide example to reflect the intention of the proposals, but not to prescribe specific methods on how the entity needs to capture significant increase in credit risk on a portfolio basis. So I'll then go to agenda paper 5C and 5D, and we can open for discussion then. So agenda paper 5C discusses the measurement objective for financial instruments that have not had a significant increase in credit risk, so stage one. And there the feedback was that most respondents agreed that there is no conceptual basis for the 12-month expected loss, however, that they supported the 12-month expected loss as a proxy to adjust the interest revenue for the initial expected credit losses over time and as a practical balance of cost and benefit. Support was also based on being able to build on existing regulatory data and budgeting cycles and the greater reliability of determining the risk of a default occurring in the next 12 months compared to a lifetime loss assessment. Respondents also suggested some alternatives, but most of these alternatives were already previously considered by the board. So, for example, loss emergence period, foreseeable future, or a stage one loss allowance that's greater than 12 months expected losses. In the discussions in September, the board also considered whether not to recognize any allowance for assets in stage one, but tentatively decided to confirm the 12-month expected credit losses as the measurement objective for instruments that are in stage one. The last decision-making paper was paper 5D, that was the definition of default, and the ISB discussed whether we should define default. The proposals did not define default. People were allowed to apply their own definitions that align with their credit risk management objective, and one of the reasons why the board didn't define default was also that we don't get into problems of how the models are calibrated and the definition that's then used for accounting reasons, and it was based on the assumptions that an earlier or a later definition of default is not going to have an impact on expected losses because the LGD is going to adjust accordingly. So the feedback that we got was that respondents didn't agree with the ISB, and some of these respondents said that yes, the definition of default impacts the population of defaults considered for stage one, so it has an impact on the measurement for assets with a 12-month expected loss. It also has an impact on the assessment of significant deterioration, and there's an impact with the stage three assets. So at the meeting, the board considered four alternatives, whether to prescribe a quantitative definition of default, so for example, let's say it's 180 days, or to have a qualitative definition of default, so to also address technical defaults, earlier indicators of defaults rather than just non-payment, to have a rebuttable presumption or not to define defaults, or similar, keep what is in the proposals right now. And the ISB decided that it would require a default definition to be applied that is consistent with credit risk management practice, that it emphasizes that qualitative factors of default should be considered when appropriate. So if in credit risk management you would have a definition that is earlier than non-payment, so for example, a breach of covenants, then that definition should be used. So and to include a rebuttable presumption that default does not occur later than 90 days past due unless the entity has reasonable and supportable information that support a non-payment definition that is later than 90 days past due. So these three papers were decision-making papers. We then also had a paper about the fieldwork, and a lot of the observations that are in that paper, in that fieldwork paper, were also observations that we shared already with you at the last meeting. So these three decisions plus the fieldwork was discussed at the ISB meeting. Maybe before I open for discussion or your comments, if I just maybe briefly touch on additional topics that will still be discussed at a future meeting. So the October, we're in October already soon, so the October board meeting, the ISB plans to discuss the measurement of expected credit losses, then the operational simplifications such as the rebuttable presumption and the low credit risk simplification, and we are also going to discuss modifications. So basically these aspects of the general model, and then going forward after that we will discuss for example scope topics like what about loan commitments, financial guarantee contracts, what about fair value OCI assets. We are going to talk about trade receivables and lease receivables after that, and disclosure, transition, and effective date. In terms of the timeline, the plan is that we re-deliberate those topics by the end of the year so that we can proceed and finalize or make the decision whether we finalize those proposals or convergence. But if we finalize those, our proposals, the plan would be to finalize in the first half year of 2014. So with this, open for any comments, questions, observations.
Roger?
Just on the portfolio, you end up with, a delayed recognition of impairments. And I've got some sympathy with that, and presumably it may almost be the norm, because when you sell a fresh lot of loans, you don't expect many to default early on. You expect the defaults to normally to happen a bit later. Presumably you've looked at and rejected the idea of recording the expected losses on the portfolio each year, deducting the losses that have actually been incurred, so that you actually will be building up a portfolio provision.
So that we, can you say that again? What was the suggestion? To look at the initial default expectations over the life and then recognize each year like a
Well, if the portfolios, you expect the portfolio to be priced, so you expected 10% defaults over 5 years, so you're expecting a 10% a year default rate. So presumably you've rejected the idea of just booking 2% each year minus the defaults you've actually got. If that would ensure that you didn't have late recognition of a lot of defaults.
I guess that was, we looked at something along those lines with the time proportionate approach and supplementary documents, and it didn't get much traction. And I guess one of the challenges is that because of open portfolios, which is what everybody always brings up, sort of trying to track initial expectations and compare them with changes is always difficult to capture the deterioration effect as opposed to the effect of just new things coming in. So, it's operational.
That would be a problem, though, regardless of this approach, because if you do have a deterioration, you're expected to recognise it. So you've got that problem of tracking it in any event.
Yeah, but yes, you do have a tracking consideration, but the difference, which seems to matter a lot for the preparers, is that they only need to track the sort of credit quality, so the sort of rating, the sort of risk grade of a loan, if you like, as opposed to the actual loss expectations. Yeah. And so they see that as being less generous.
Sorry.
Mike? I think we'd just like to commend the board for continuing with its outreach and efforts and say that, yes, we are supportive of the direction of travel. I think, unlike the last two topics we discussed today, there's much more of a consensus we hear from our constituents around this. Not to say it pleases everybody, nothing will ever please everybody, but there's much more consensus that this is the right direction. I think that the trick in finalising this is going to be to avoid using language in the actual standard that pigeonholes people into doing things one way or another way. So the more you can keep it at an objective level and give guidance examples, preferably examples which overlap so that people realise they're just examples and not prescriptive, I think the better. But I think we're very supportive of the approach to date.
Alexander?
Some financial institutions already have an expected loss model operating because of other regulatory needs, so they already have one. But I believe that most countries, the current model, it's PD times LGD times EAD, okay, that's no problem. But the probability of default does not change from 12 months to lifetime at once. They go on a more kind of continuous way. So it don't go from 12 to there are more frequent calibrations like on PD. So PD changes and in the bank that I work, for example, we change that every month, so it can have a new PD every. Of course, they do not change for everybody, but it can change every month.
And you're saying it basically increases from a 12-month PD, let's say, to a 24-month PD, or are you saying it's being updated, the 12-month PD, to new estimates?
It's updated, but of course, as there is a deterioration, it's updated after 12-month PD, gets closer to lifetime. You can reach a certain level that's the probability of default in the next 12 months is almost equal to the probability of default in the next 24 months because it's already very high. So, is this approach acceptable? I'm afraid of to have two. We're going to have three different PDs. Now it's going to have a 12-month PD, it's going to have a lifetime PD, and have a more continuously calibrated.
Well, you have basically you start off with your 12. So generally, assets start off in stage one with a 12-month expected loss allowance, which means you're going to use your 12-month PD times LGD times EAD if you have such a model.
5%.
So you use your it's a 12-month PD is 5%. You're going to use 5%.
The lifetime is 20, just to give an example.
Okay, so you're going to use 5% as a 12-month PD times the LGD times the EAD. So the next period, you are basically looking at your estimate at the reporting date. So has my probability of default increased, or is it still stays as 5%? If it hasn't increased or hasn't changed, there's basically the allowance should always reflect your expected losses, so you have no P&L effect. If your probability of default increases, you're updating your 12-month expected loss allowance. But you need to consider whether the change in your estimate, basically, if your default expectations over the life have increased significantly. If your default expectations over the life have increased significantly, so for example, if you think you would actually reprice the loan because of the changes in credit risks, it has, some people look at a downgrade in their internal rating systems, then you would move that loan into stage two and recognize lifetime expected losses, in which case you can't use the 12-month PD anymore. You would need to use, in your example, it was the 20%
If my example, my 12-month PD is 17%, so then I have to have two data. I need two databases. Even if I believe that in the next 12 months is 17%, for example, I have to move to 20%, which is the lifetime.
Well, if it's a significant increase in the probability of default over the life, then you need to move to lifetime expected losses.
Now, I'm just thinking about the benefit of that, because I already have a model that I'm comfortable with working with it. My back tests confirm that. And say there is an interval. It's not the lifetime PD, but it's another number that is. It's because I understand the concept of original, a time zero, 12-month PD, and it's inappropriate if you get a deterioration. But then you move from 12-month to lifetime with an interval.
I think it might be, and I might also need to ask you a question just to get a better understanding for myself, but in the initial phases, what we're talking about is not a change in the measurement method. You're simply talking about a change in PD that happens over a period of time.
Yeah.
That initial change in PD gets captured in stage one.
Yeah.
Simply as it moves from, say, 5% to 6% to 7%, you will capture that in stage one until such time as you hit significant deterioration.
So
from a board view, significant deterioration is the point in time at which the interest that you expect to recover is no longer sufficient to cover for the losses that you expect. And that point, we are, exactly as you're saying, we are going to be changing the underlying measurement technique. But I think those initial losses that you're talking about, the initial sort of graduated process, probably gets captured in our system because in stage one, as a graduated process, because there isn't significant deterioration yet.
Any update which is not lifetime PG would be captured at stage one as an increase in the original PG.
Yep.
And then
as long as I am on stage one, I have the same PD.
Correct.
Yeah,
I have two PD. Then I have
the 12-month PD that's updated every reporting period until there's significant deterioration. When there's significant deterioration, that's when you would move to the lifetime expected loss.
It's only my question and my doubt, but I think that deserves a little bit of clarification, because as I understood originally, you have a 12-month PD, and if you got this, I could not use the same system because there's an enormous difference in terms of cost.
Yeah, no, you can.
As long as you're using a 12-month PD, you can update that as they are updating it now. Bodily requirements.
No, you can, and you should.
As long as it's a 12.
At each reporting date, adjust your estimate.
12-month PD. Yeah. As long as it is a 12-month PD, but an update.
As long as you're in the stage one.
That's good.
Any more questions?
I'm not so enthusiastic on 5A. The conclusion I support the explanation of top-down approach and the bottom-up approach may create new questions. So I think explanation should be stopped somewhere. So only example sufficient enough to retain flexibility.
I think to Mike's point, we're trying to keep it very much objective-based, and the main takeaway from the discussion about this, how forward-looking the model should be and how you deal with situations where you can't identify deterioration at an individual level was really primarily designed to make it clear that you weren't limited to where you could see on an individual basis, that you should be thinking more holistically in a portfolio level. And I think that the main purpose of the examples will really be not so much to tell people how to do the calculations, because I don't think we're the specialists that should be dictating that. Rather, it will be talking about the types of fact patterns where you probably need to be careful. So there's some examples in the paper of situations where you may have expectations about changes in interest rates that mean that you think there's been an increase in the portfolio. You can't see the effect of that yet, but that would be a situation where you'd need to think about whether there's been significant deterioration or not. And I think my preference would be for the examples to be more focused on the types of fact patterns where you need to think about it, rather than saying and go about it by doing, you know, this approach, a top-down approach, a bottom-down approach. We might just acknowledge that that type of thinking could be used to help you work out what your calculation should be, not being prescriptive about it.
So can people use reasonable justification of such ratio? So is it easy to use such explanations for applying? So I think it is not clear enough.
I mean, sticking on the same theme about this question of how do you apply a lifetime expected loss when you think there has been some deterioration but you can't identify it, you can perhaps identify it to a portfolio. My understanding of the proposals and how you're articulating it is that you would be allowed to take a view that would not require you to apply a lifetime expected loss to a whole portfolio, but to merely consider that certain elements of that portfolio would have become more risky and therefore to apply
that. Absolutely.
And I think that's very important.
And that was also one of the concern of some of the field participants, that they would need to move the entire portfolio to lifetime expected losses, even if they think only a portion of their book is affected. So that's why we were thinking of different approaches of how can you actually identify that only a portion of your book is affected. And as Sue said, we don't want to prescribe how you make that assessment.
But we want to make it clear that just because there's been deterioration across the portfolio doesn't mean the whole thing needs to move.
Yeah.
But neither should you ignore it totally either.
Exactly, yeah.
And rather use the best information that you have available without undue cost and effort to try and best identify the sources of the significant deterioration at a sub-portfolio level.
And I think that's going to be quite an important area, to give as many different examples as you can and draw them from as much real life as you can in terms of the field participants, etc.
Okay. Jan, I'd be interested to know from the field testing, what is the feedback been with regards to, I guess, moving instruments from bucket one to bucket two under this proposed model versus the existing IS39 incurred loss model? And I suppose at face value for me, a concern at face value would be, in practice, are we potentially not going to have diversity around, you know, the timing of moving to bucket two? So, you know, the current 39 model has been criticised for recording losses too late. I guess at face value, I'm a bit concerned that people might end up by saying, well, no, I don't actually have a significant increase in credit risk yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so for that reason, nothing moves.
Maybe Heal, our
take on
champion, will take on that question.
Okay, I think in terms of where we are today, I think what the fieldwork did confirm is there's a variety of practices. So obviously what the model is trying to achieve is consistency in one of the things. In terms of moving to bucket two, yes, there is divergence in various ways that you can do it, but not to an extreme. I think some of the points that we are trying to clarify with You Can Move a Portfolio was trying to address issues that people had that would increase consistency and what is the objective. So, for example, just thinking about Paper 5A, we did not want to make people move just on 30 days, for example, unless obviously that is the point. And that is why there's certain backstops, almost, to make sure that if you missed it through other information, you should still try more forward-looking information, all of that, but then putting a backstop in that there is a point where there is consistency. I think from field participants, it's quite interesting. The more you can apply forward-looking information and the better you become, the more they find it beneficial for themselves. So there's not like the incentive to wait too long. It's more an incentive to make sure you get it right early on. So hopefully through that, there is consistency. I think where practice will develop is if, let's say, you're in a PD-based model or internal ratings. So nobody's got the same internal rating scale. It's trying to define when you would consider significant increase in credit risk. But I don't think the space for moving is as big maybe as what people have thought today in I-35.
I think it's also worth saying that one of the sources possibly of differences in the way people applied the model that we saw in the field test was that if you had individual level data earlier, behavioral scoring and the like, you were recognizing earlier than if you had to, if you were in this portfolio situation where you were deciding whole portfolio or nothing. So part of the decision I think we arrived at in paper A actually helps bring the parties closer together, because it means even if you don't have the individual level, that doesn't absolve you from recognizing a significant deterioration that you believe is there. So I think if anything, we probably need to closer together than what we saw in the initial field test results.
And I think that was the feedback from participants almost saying, and it comes back to a point Mike made earlier in terms of we must make our objectives and principles clear and illustrate what we mean, because sometimes in that case, for example, people said, well, they feel almost we are prohibiting them to recognize losses, which we really weren't trying to do. But it's now making clear that, yes, it's not the entire portfolio or the individual ones. You can have portions of a portfolio moving over.
Yes, I agree. The fieldwork did show that there were a number of people who did think that we mean you only recognize lifetime expected losses if you can identify it on an individual level. Yeah. So,
Bing?
To share an observation, I don't know where can I find any further guidance on a specific issue. You know, in our field test, we have done some field tests in mainland China, and we found if you have to determine whether a specific portfolio or ISIs, financial ISIs, have a significant deterioration on credit risk, you have to estimate the whole life, the whole lifetime PD. Uh-huh. The only basis, the main basis, the main start point to the whole lifetime, the lifetime, entire lifetime PD is the 12 months PD, extracted from their risk management system. The problem is, because from 2013 to 2016. The first group and second group of Chinese banks get the criterion, achieve the requirements by the CBRC, the Chinese Banking Regulatory Department committee. So that's who see. In the field test, at the time of field test, they got only 4 years data. Backward data, and the result of the entire lifetime PD is very doubtful. Almost everybody noted that might be lower than supposed to be. So, is there any will you do something?
Can to maybe just clarify when them going backward, is it? Is it estimating the loss that's the problem, or estimating a probability of default?
Default.
Okay, so they don't have historic data to predict lifetime going forward what they think the level of default is?
Actually, they are using, for example, the first data available year is 2009, and then the second in 2010, 2011, 2012. They can establish three times model. The first one is from 2009 to 2010, and 2010 to 2011, 2011 to 2012. So only three times. Most of the lifetime of the loans issued by Chinese banks are on average about 5 years. Some less than 5 years, and about 20% to 30% is over 5 years. Some of them are up to 20 or 30. So for it's not a big deal on the purpose of field test, but everybody noted that the result, the estimated result based on very limited data resources is quite notable.
I think the reality will be that you probably have to improve application post-transition because you're going to have a data issue, and I guess the starting point would be to try and firstly to look mostly at things like your credit risk grading systems to see whether there's been deterioration rather than focusing on something as formalistic as a probability of default if you don't have it. So you don't have to actually, to determine significant deterioration, have the probability of default, so you can use other ways to try and measure the credit deterioration that could work based on the information that you have.
You mean some alternative other ways?
Like your internal risk grading?
And that's actually something we also are going to take to the board in October. That the intention is not to prescribe such a mechanistic approach that you have to have the lifetime PD term curve for each individual loan.
Yeah, but that's actually the next issue I would like to talk, because to some smaller scale banks, maybe that's a good idea. But to the top ones, we prefer to have a more fixed, more formal mechanism or methodology.
Well, it wouldn't prevent you from calculating the lifetime term structure for your loans, and the fieldwork also showed that the banks that participated in the fieldwork, for example, used very data-rich portfolios, and they looked at the lifetime term PD structure, for example, for those loans, but similar to what you are saying for other portfolios, that it's not as data-rich, and they won't be able, or it will be too much effort to produce it for each loan, so they were going to use a different method there.
And I think what you would find from the fieldwork is that it tends to be, if it's the more complex entities, they have more complex structures, and the more simpler ones used more simple type calculations to do it, and it all worked for all of them within their credit risk structure.
We are talking in China. We are talking about a simplified method to achieve this. But more scenario we discussed is for smaller banks, not the big ones. So yeah, thank you for your idea. But anyway, I go back to my colleague from CBRC as well to move to discuss this further.
And as Jana said, in October we're going to bring a paper which will talk about this assessment of deterioration, because a lot of people read the words in the document very literally. I suppose you should read words very literally, but because we used the term probability of default, they thought that meant you always had to do a probability of default calculation. What we really meant was risk of default, and you can look at that using different metrics, and we want to try and emphasise that in the October paper.
Mike? One observation, one question, I suppose, and the observation, what Kevin said, I mean, again, I would urge the board to resist any temptation to be overly prescriptive in anything, because how people apply this is going to be different. It is a very judgmental area, and you are never going to be able to prescribe a standard that says the answer is X, however much, frankly, regulators may like that. The second one, though, is a question, because one of the big areas I perceive from practice in terms even of the existing standard in calculating impairment is that people take a very different view of likely cash flows once they're into impairment territory. And of course, at the moment, the model is discounted the EIR, and the EIR is never actually a very good number for discounting what are by then quite uncertain cash flows. So depending upon whether you take a prudent view of those cash flows or a best estimate view or an imprudent view, or however you like to describe it, you get very, very different answers. And I don't know whether you're planning on bringing to the board any further discussion of the interest rate that you are suggesting might be allowed, because you had a multiplicity of potential interest rates in there, which clearly, again, just adds to the potential for that. But I do think there is a question, once you are into evaluating impairments, of actually thinking about whether the interest rate stroke cash flow should have some better correlation than they do today, in terms of making people build some of the uncertainty into at least one or the other.
What exactly are you thinking of?
Well, if you've got a case in point that I came across recently was that a bank had been financing a property development, very long-term property development, 5 or 6 years before it was all going to come to fruition. And therefore, when the loan was originally taken out, there was effectively some equity backing for this property development. By the time they came to look at the impairment, there was no equity backing for this property development. If you value that property development using a market value technique today, then the valuer would go in and he would discount it at, say, 20%, because that was reflective of the fact of that was the uncertainty about the project, mm-hmm. not the uncertainty about the loan, the uncertainty about the project. The EIR was probably 8%, which was on the basis at the time when the loan was taken out, there was some equity backing, which had, if you like, the uncertainty of the cash flows of the project built into it. Today it doesn't. Now, therefore, depending upon what view you took of the cash flows, whether you took a best estimate of the cash flows and say, well, actually, because I'm now the sole owner of this project, those are all going to flow to me and I discount those at 8%, or you say, actually, those are very uncertain cash flows and I'm now going to knock numbers off the uncertainty and discount that at 8%, or whether you take the original and say, well, okay, but I'm going to get the same answer as building uncertainty in the cash flows if I discount the whole thing at 20%. And you get very different answers. Very different answers.
Undoubtedly.
And if you're talking about where there are deviations in practice, even under today's model, that is one of the biggest areas there are today. So if people are looking to drive some more consistency, it's an area where you need to think about it, given that actually, if anything, you've expanded the potential for inconsistency because of the view you are expressing on the ability to pick interest rates to use.
It's an interesting point. In terms of the easy question and amongst all of that, we are going to look at the measurement of expected losses in October, and one of the things we'll look at there will be the discounting question. Your point's an interesting one. Not many people commented on discount rate that came back to us, but I would say some of the of our stakeholders who perhaps spent the most time running numbers and thinking about calculations, if I can put it that way, cautioned us about the flexibility of choice of interest rate in the model and said that in some jurisdictions it could have a profound effect in terms of what the calculations would be. And so their recommendation was that we be more specific in terms of what the discount rate should be. But I think most of those people probably said, and that should be the EIR, because it sort of ties in with the integrated amortized cost model. And so I think we'd have to think about what you've just raised.
But I think it is a judgmental calculation, and even it's very difficult to come up with the exact timing of when your cash flows should not occur. And then another precision is maybe, okay, then use the right really discount rate. But I think that is to an extreme, and I think what we want to achieve is more make it more easier, and maybe then maybe have to look at the effective interest rate. Maybe it is not in all circumstances the right risk-adjusted, I agree to that.
Well, it, oh, you can use EIR, but it cautioned people that they should be.
But if he would require that, really,
just in the cash flow, so that it's consistent with that discount rate, perhaps we could deal with it in the reverse.
Well, and that adds a lot of complexity. What you're suggesting is you're moving much more closer to a current value.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, why don't you just say fair value?
Well,
you're getting pretty close.
But, and the problem is, if you've got a loan which is entirely where actually you're dependent on the entire cash flows of whatever it is you've lent to, that's really where you've wiped out all equity. It gets very tricky. But that's quite a lot. If you think what caused the last financial crisis is the property lending. What's caused most financial crises is property lending. What happens in property lending? Well, the capital gets wiped out and the loans are left naked.
Alexander?
I think one of the biggest criticisms of this project is about the cost of implementation. This thing. And one thing that I believe people are missing, and at least I believe this should be noted, that for most portfolios that are shorter term portfolios instead of mortgages, taking away this kind of, actually the 12 month PD and the lifetime PD, the difference will be material.
Yes,
I have a 16 month. I have 16-month PD, 16-month maturity contract, 12-month PD, and the lifetime PD is going to be the same. So maybe something that it could be used, if you agree, of course, is interesting to clarify, because if I have a certain let's put it another way, if the difference is immaterial, I believe they could use the same database. And for certain maturities, I believe the difference is, I'm sure the difference is
but
material.
But the general, I guess, materiality guidance applies, so I don't think it's...
But again, we had the discussion yesterday about maturity. When you say lifetime PD, people get as a command to have a lifetime PD. And I think a comment on materiality is interesting. I don't think that people got that impression.
In the field work, for example, we didn't only have financial institutions who participated, also corporates. And they had some of their portfolios were quite short term, so they basically chose a lifetime loss model exactly for that reason. Why should we track significant deterioration if the difference between a 12-month and a lifetime isn't significant?
The question is, then financial institutions are going to find the opposite. They already have a 12-month.
Yes.
Yeah.
To have that amount of PD.
Yeah.
And I think the way
the cost-benefit analysis of moving to lifetime PD is
I think the way that we had also been thinking in drafting the ED on that is that, so like you're saying, for most financial institutions, the 12-month is in place, and so they do have these systems of deterioration. So that's not for them. But when we got to the leasing and the corporate entity, but that was the area where it was felt, well, it is appropriate, one, because it is usually short-term, so it's going to be very little difference. And what the field work then confirmed, as Jana said, well, when it is short, they would pick lifetime. If it's longer, they see the benefit in implementing then the general model.
Yeah, maybe my comment is more related to the discussion we had yesterday, that materiality applies here the same way. So.
Even in one of the comments, in our future meetings that's coming, so even when it is like fair value OCI, that is also what some people have said. If it's fair value OCI, very high quality materiality considerations come in again. Mm-hmm. So I think participants were cognizant of the fact to think about materiality in the context of what's happening.
Are there any other comments? Yes.
Sorry. It's an issue for the 12 months ECL. And we noted you have reaffirmed that a 12 months ECL doesn't mean only ECL in the next 12 months.
Yes.
Yeah. It's used some data based on the lifetime, not only 12 months, but what supposed to be occurred in the next 12 months. Did I miss any guidance in the ED, or you will provide further on this, on what you just reaffirmed? It's quite important.
Well, I think it comes to words, you mean to clarify that when we talk about a stage one allowance, it is lifetime expected credit losses adjusted for 12-month probability. Yes, I think the consensus raised is maybe is the wording that we use by talking about 12-month expected credit losses, but meaning a concept behind that.
For the clarification.
Yes.
I think some people suggest that's wording. Some people suggested that we maybe draw on kind of the wording we had in our snapshot, which some people thought was much more clear, that it's basically your lifetime cash flows that you need to consider. So if you default in the next 12 months, what's going to be the entire shortfall that you have? But that's more, I think, clarification, drafting.
We appreciate point. You can provide something, for example, considering the macro economic environments, something like this, or the economies circles. Because some people would be confused by different based time months expect PD. Because they would like to know what kind of consideration factors exactly to be considered, to be included in their consideration.
Can I ask a question? So does this confusion come from the banking industry even, or
from the financial department of banks, rather than risk management.
I think that's something we see general in the project. Credit risk people and accounting and finance people have a very different understanding and knowledge. So, okay.
Any final questions? No. Then we are done with impairment.
Yep, from our side. Yeah.
Shall we continue straight on to conceptual framework? Yeah. You need to find the people, conceptual people.